including many who have parroted the dangerous lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, in a bid to ensure that Congress is full of lawmakers willing to make their wealthy benefactors even richer, according to a fresh analysis. Titled Billionaires Buying Elections, the report from Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, details how billionaires are increasingly using their personal fortunes and the profits of connected corporations to drown out regular voters' voices and elect hand-picked candidates who fed or rig the nation's economy, especially the tax system. A pair of super PACs tasked with securing Republican majorities in the House and Senate, the Congressional Leadership Fund, CLF, and the Senate Leadership Fund, SLF, raised a combined $188.3 million through the first 16 months of the 2022 campaign cycle, according to ATF. Nearly half, $89.4 million, or 48%, came from just 27 billionaires. A whopping 86% of the GOP's billionaire money came from Wall Street tycoons, who are arguably the biggest beneficiaries of glaring loopholes in the tax code. The Democratic counterparts of those two super PACs, the House Majority PAC and the Senate Majority PAC, raised a combined $154 million over the same time period. Smaller share, $25.8 million, or 17%, came from 19 billionaires. A majority of billionaire contributions to Democratic candidates also came from the finance and investment sector, about 35%, but other industries were also well represented, including cryptocurrency, 26%, and tech, 18%. Unlike candidates and party committees, super PACs can raise unlimited donations from individuals and corporations, ATF explained. In return, they are not supposed to coordinate activities with the campaigns they support, but instead act independently, though that rule is often flouted. Top billionaire donors to congressional super PACs include hedge fund magnate Ken Griffin, who has given more than $28.5 million to CLF and SLF, and private equity mogul Stephen Schwarzman, who has pumped $20 million into GOP's super PACs. Anti-democratic vote-buying, ATF wrote, has been facilitated by and is facilitating the accelerating wealth growth of the billionaire class and the record profits of the corporations they won. The combined net worth of the nation's roughly 750 billionaires surged by $2 trillion, or 70%, during the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic. The collective wealth of the 27 billionaires bankrolling the GOP super PACs alone soared by $82.4 billion over that time period, meaning that the $89.4 million they have donated to CLF and SLF constitutes less than 0.1% of their overall pandemic-era gains. Meanwhile, the return on that modest investment could amount to billions of dollars if Republicans take back Congress in November and preserve their 2017 tax cuts or further slash taxes on super-rich people and the corporations they won. Over a recent 9-year period, the 400 wealthiest people in the U.S. paid an average effective federal income tax rate of just 8.2% when the increased value of their stock holdings is included in their income. That is a lower rate than the nationwide average of 13.3% in 2019. As ATF explained, focusing on contributions to congressional super PACs, fails to capture the full political influence of billionaires who, in addition to personal donations, also steer money to favored candidates from related corporations and organizations. Billionaires are among the ultra-wealthy Americans who control corporations through their extensive stock holdings. Many corporate giants have been distorting the upcoming midterms, ATF pointed out, by spending tens of millions to help GOP candidates who have vowed to defend the special tax breaks for the top 1% get elected, including 144 far-right members of Congress who voted to overturn President Biden's electoral victory. According to the report, seven powerful corporations, including AT&T, Chevron, ExxonMobil, FedEx, GM, Merrick and Ops have collectively given nearly $1.5 million to dozens of election deniers and various Republican PACs and election committees this campaign cycle. The companies demonstrated lack of concern for democracy, ATF noted, likely stems from their desire to keep dodging taxes. In 2021, these firms paid an average federal income tax rate of just 2.7% on a combined $78.4 billion in profits. Notably, Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, who is worth about $5 billion and openly opposed to democracy, has been spending big on his preferred Republican candidates, but not through the GOP's congressional super PACs. Thiel has so far spent almost $30 million through super PACs, supporting the 2022 senatorial bids of two firms. And employees who share his anti-democratic and anti-tax beliefs, ATF found, adding, J.D. Vance won the Ohio Republican U.S. Senate primary thanks in part to Thiel's $15 million in spending. Blake Masters has a fighting chance in Arizona's GOP U.S. Senate primary in August due to Thiel's $13.5 million in contributions. Another source of billionaire dominance of campaign financing, especially on the Republican side, wrote ATF, are so-called dark money groups, which are not required to disclose the identity of their donors. Some dark money groups, including Club for Growth, which has received $32 million from billionaire Wall Street trader Jeffrey Yes over the years, are notorious for having bankrolled insurrectionist members of Congress like Senator Josh Hawley and Lauren Boebert, ATF noted. According to the report, politically active billionaire Charles Koch has personally donated to either GOP Super PAC this cycle, but his corporation Koch Industries has so far given them a total of $1.75 million. Two of the biggest dark money groups, which do not disclose their donors, are essentially sister groups to the two congressional GOP Super PACs. American Action Network gave at least $26 million to CLF in the 2020 cycle and $18.7 million so far this cycle. One Nation donated $77.5 million to SLF last cycle and has given $16.5 million so far this cycle. The ability of the nation's wealthiest individuals to translate their disproportionate economic power into political clout has increased exponentially since the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision eliminated effective limits on campaign contributions. According to the report, billionaires pumped $1.2 billion into the 2020 elections, almost 40 times more than the $31 million they donated in 2010, when the Citizens United rules were first in effect. In the 2020 election cycle, billionaires contributed nearly $1 out of every $10, while making up just 0.1% of all donors contributing more than $200. Billionaires donated almost $240 million to the combined campaign efforts of Donald Trump's two runs for president. Over half came from just one billionaire household, that of magnate Sheldon Adelson, who has since died. Billionaires who are used to buying whatever they want have increasingly dedicated their almost unlimited resources to buying American elections, Frank Clement, executive director of ATF, said in a statement. The problem is what's good for billionaires, including cutting taxes on the rich and corporations. It's bad for working families, said Clement. We need to rein in billionaire political and economic power through campaign finance reforms and tax reforms, such as a billionaire's income tax. Several legislative proposals have emerged to tax the increased value of assets owned by the nation's wealthiest households each year, regardless of whether they sell or keep them, which would ensure that income derived from wealth is taxed more like income earned from work. Biden's plan would raise an estimated $360 billion over 10 years, while Senator Ron Wyden's plan would raise an estimated $550 billion over a decade, and Representative Jamal Bowman's proposal possibly even more. Billionaire-backed Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, however, has joined Senate Republicans in opposing such a measure.
American immigrant family.
Part 1.
We've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country. This is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida in 1998. Samir found work and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son Yusuf was missing.
A friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him, he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that will hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they are going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even these legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, they don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son, and you know your son is innocent, you're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him.
Justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them. And we have to support law enforcement
who
want to fight
them.
You know, Clinton goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they kill
innocent
people.
And that's got to be the last word.
If you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's always confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violence. I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a five-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
The atmosphere and the environment in the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release a tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program, and of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hamoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Yusuf Magahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment of Sami Al-Aryan and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hamouda.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday. And I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me. And things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all, in their thought, to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did. And this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Yusuf's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials, as a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to successfully represent this individual. The media reaction was that this was some sort of terrorist-related activity. The United States Attorney's Office, although not saying that, certainly wasn't saying it wasn't. And that sort of swelled around this case.
Gary Meringer served as the foreman of the jury in Yusuf Megahed's trial. He says the tone for the trial was set on the very first day.
The judge asked, "Does anybody here consider themselves an expert with explosives?" And then, and he followed that with, "Is anybody here fluent in Arabic?" And not knowing at all, when you go into being paneled on a jury, you don't know anything about the case. Just some person sitting there in a business suit, and all of a sudden I'm hearing Arabs and explosives, and it was like, whoa.
I mean, if you ask the man on the street, "Hey, the defendant's from the Middle East, and the government's alleging he's got explosive materials in his trunk," all of my colleagues said, "There's no way you're going to win this at trial."
We listened to almost two full weeks of evidence. 40-plus witnesses were put on by the government. I don't know how many documents. It was, I think, over 100.
As the evidence came in, and it kept pointing away from Yusuf, and it kept showing that, you know, if even though there was no physical evidence tying him to it, once it became clear that these items were completely harmless, I felt we should win at trial, and we could win at trial.
The jury, after 3 days of looking hard and fast at the evidence, said, you know, it's the burden of the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in possession of these materials and that he knew it. It's not sufficient that you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not guilty of a crime in this country. And there was, the feeling was, you know, there really wasn't any evidence of that.
When the verdict was not guilty, it was a wonderful feeling. There were tears from the client and the family, and probably the best hug I've ever received from my client's father. Several of the agents that worked for the FBI came up and congratulated us and told us that they were not dissatisfied with the verdict in the case. And it was good to know, and I think I was even quoted in the paper as saying, you know, the system worked. As a lawyer who tries cases and understands the Constitution and the purpose of jury trials and the whole notion that the jury is the true representation of our government. It's a check on our government, and it's what makes us America, is that it's not the government that decides whether somebody's guilty. It's the community, because we are government of the people. And the people in this case, despite all the government's best efforts, said, you know what, you're wrong. It was about one of the proudest days I've ever had as a lawyer professionally. It was wonderful.
We went in and talked to the judge. He counseled us never to talk to anybody ever again about anything that had happened. And as a result of that, we all took all of our notes and all the charts and everything, and we just gave them to the bailiff to shred and burn, and thinking we would never, ever revisit this.
Well, he was acquitted of federal explosive charges just this past Friday, but today Yusuf Megahed is back in the hands of federal agents, and his family tonight is outraged.
On Friday, after a three-week trial, Yusuf Megahed walked out of a Tampa courthouse a free man.
I'm very happy.
Megahed was acquitted on all counts of federal explosives charges, but his freedom was short-lived. Monday, to the surprise of his father, Megahed was arrested all over again.
They arrest my son. They kidnap my son.
Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, says they were walking out of this Walmart on Bruce B. Downs when more than a dozen customs enforcement agents surrounded them.
They separated between me and my son, and they surround me. I tried to use the telephone. They didn't allow me to use the telephone. And put the Yusuf in a small car. I tried to stop in front of this car to let Yusuf to speak to his lawyer. They didn't allow me to do this thing. They kidnapped my son.
I would have personally walked into wherever he needed to be, but instead they chose to surveil him for days after the trial and to arrest him and his father as they are walking out of a grocery store, and to surround them by cars and agents and whisk him away in a vehicle.
Tuesday morning, I got to work, I opened up my browser, pulled up the news, and I saw that Yusuf had been arrested on Monday at a Walmart with his dad by immigration authorities. And this has only happened, and I was thinking about this morning, when I saw the Grand Canyon was another example, but where the air got sucked out of my lungs. I read the story and was like, like that. It just was so improbable. After all the time we had spent to find out that he hadn't done anything.
I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be an American. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again.
Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in, like, 2 or 3 days just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like, for the first, I think, week or two, like, even, like, my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was, like, unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community, when my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the room, observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether I'll be able to see him again, whether he'll, you know, just be there for, like, these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport, I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait.
He would try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and, like, nothing would come out of it, and then different promises. And then at the end, they told us, if you just leave voluntarily, we promise he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer, he told him, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't, like, have an idea of what's going on, and we kept trying to get in touch with people. And, like, she was kind of freaking out, because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of, you know, being deported and traveling in a T-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has, my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I mean, you know, I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. This is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government
made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation, they have ruined my good name, and they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Over the course of this summer, the nation has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Donald Trump is Not Above the Law, and it's been written by the editorial board of the newspaper. Over the course of this summer, America has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The Justice Department remained largely silent about its investigations of the former president until this month, when the FBI searched his home in Palm Beach, Florida, in a case related to his handling of classified documents. The spectacle of a former president facing criminal investigation raises profound questions about American democracy, and these questions demand answers. Donald Trump's unprecedented assault on the integrity of American democracy requires a criminal investigation. The disturbing details of his post-election malfeasance, meticulously assembled by the January 6th committee, leave little doubt that Mr. Trump sought to subvert the Constitution and overturn the will of the American people. The president, defeated at the polls in 2020, tried to enlist federal law enforcement authorities, state officials, and administrators of the nation's electoral system in a furious effort to remain in power. When all else failed, he roused an armed mob that stormed the Capitol and threatened lawmakers. The Justice Department is reportedly examining Mr. Trump's conduct, including his role in trying to overturn the election and in taking home classified documents. If Attorney General Merrick Garland and his staff conclude that there is sufficient evidence to establish Donald Trump's guilt on a serious charge in a court of law, then they must seek an indictment too. This board is aware that in deciding how Donald Trump should be held accountable under the law, it is necessary to consider not just whether criminal prosecution would be warranted, but whether it would be wise. No American president has ever been criminally prosecuted after leaving office. When President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he ensured that Nixon would not be prosecuted for crimes committed during the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford explained his decision with the warning that such a prosecution posed grave risks of rousing ugly passions and worsening political polarization. That warning is just as salient today. Pursuing prosecution of Donald Trump could further entrench support for him and play into the conspiracy theories he has sought to stoke. It could inflame the bitter partisan divide, even to the point of civil unrest. A trial, if it is viewed as illegitimate, could also further undermine confidence in the rule of law, whatever the eventual outcome. The risks of political escalation are obvious. The Democratic and Republican parties are already in the thick of a cycle of retribution that could last generations. There is a substantial risk that, if the Justice Department does prosecute Donald Trump, future presidents, whether Mr. Trump himself or someone of his ilk, could misuse the precedent to punish political rivals. If their party takes a majority in the House of Representatives after the midterm elections, some Republicans have already threatened to impeach President Biden. There is an even more immediate threat of further violence, and it is a possibility that Americans should, sadly, be prepared for. In the hours after federal agents began a court-approved search of Donald Trump's residence in Palm Beach, based on a warrant investigating possible violations of three federal laws, including one that governs the handling of defense information under the Espionage Act, his most fervent supporters escalated their rhetoric to the language of warfare. As the New York Times noted, the aggressive widespread response was arguably the clearest outburst of violent public rhetoric since the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Merrick Garland has been deliberate, methodical, and scrupulous in his leadership of the Justice Department's investigation of the January 6th attack and the transfer of documents to Donald Trump's home. On Friday, a redacted version of the affidavit used to obtain the warrant was released, revealing that the Justice Department asked to search the premises to recover documents because of concerns that their disclosure could compromise clandestine human sources of intelligence, and because it had probable cause to believe it would find evidence of obstruction at the premises. No matter how careful Merrick Garland is, or how measured the prosecution might be, there is a real and significant risk from those who believe that any criticism of Donald Trump justifies an extreme response. Yet, it is a far greater risk to do nothing when action is called for. Aside from letting Mr. Trump escape punishment, doing nothing to hold him accountable for his actions in the months leading up to the January 6th assault could set an irresistible precedent for future presidents. Why not attempt to stay in power by any means necessary, or use the power of the office to enrich oneself or punish one's enemies, knowing that the law does not apply to presidents in or out of office? More importantly, democratic government is an ideal that must constantly be made real. America is not sustained by a set of principles, it is sustained by resolute action to defend those principles. Immediately after the January 6th insurrection, cabinet members reportedly debated privately whether to remove Donald Trump from power under the authority of the 25th Amendment. A week after the attack, the House impeached Mr. Trump for the second time. This editorial board supported his impeachment and removal from office. We also suggested that the former president and lawmakers who participated in the January 6th plot could be permanently barred from holding office under a provision of the 14th Amendment that applies to any official who has engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or given aid or comfort to those who have done so. But most Republicans in the Senate refused to convict Donald Trump, and Congress has yet to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment against him. As a result, the threat that Donald Trump and his most ardent supporters pose to American democracy has metastasized. Even now, the former president continues to spread lies about the 2020 election and denounce his vice president, Mike Pence, for not breaking the law on his behalf. Meanwhile, dozens of people who believe Mr. Trump's lies are running for state and national elected office. Many have already won, some of them elevated to positions that give them control over how elections are conducted. In June, the Republican Party in Texas approved measures in its platform declaring that Mr. Biden's election was illegitimate. And Donald Trump appears prepared to start a bid for a second term as president. Mr. Trump's actions as a public official, like no other since the Civil War, attack the heart of our system of government. He used the power of his office to subvert the rule of law. If we hesitate to call those actions and their perpetrator criminal, then we are saying he's above the law and giving license to future presidents to do whatever they want. In addition to a federal investigation by the Justice Department, Donald Trump is facing a swirl of civil and criminal liability in several other cases. A lawsuit by the Attorney General for the District of Columbia over payments during his inauguration ceremonies. A criminal investigation in Westchester County, New York, over taxes on one of his golf courses. A criminal case in Fulton County, Georgia, over interference in the 2020 presidential election. A criminal case by the Manhattan District Attorney over the valuation of Mr. Trump's properties. And a civil inquiry by New York's Attorney General into Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. The specific crimes the Justice Department could consider would likely involve Mr. Trump's fraudulent efforts to get election officials in Georgia, in Arizona, and elsewhere to declare him the winner, even though he lost in those states. To get Mike Pence, at the 6th of January congressional certification of the election, to throw out slates of electors from states he lost and replace them with electors loyal to Mr. Trump. And to enlist officials from the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, to persuade officials in certain states to swing the election to him and ultimately stir up a mob that attacked the Capitol. The government could also charge Mr. Trump with seditious conspiracy, a serious charge that federal prosecutors have already brought against leaders of far-right militia groups who participated in the Capitol invasion. The committee hearings make it clear Mr. Trump must have known he was at the center of a frantic, sprawling, and knowingly fraudulent effort that led directly to the Capitol siege. For hours, Donald Trump refused to call off the mob. The testimony from hundreds of witnesses, many of them high-ranking Republican officials from his own administration, reveals Donald Trump's unrelenting efforts, beginning months before Election Day and continuing through 6th of January, to sow doubt about the election, to refuse to accept the result of that election, and then to pursue what he must have known were illegal and unconstitutional means to overturn it. Many participants sought preemptive pardons for their conduct, an indication that they knew very well that they were violating the law. Other evidence points to other crimes like obstruction of Congress, defined as a corrupt obstruction of the proper administration of the law. The fake elector scheme that Mr. Trump and his associates pushed before January 6 appears to meet this definition. That may explain why at least three of Mr. Trump's campaign lawyers were unwilling to participate in the plot. People involved in it were told it was not legally sound by White House lawyers, but they moved forward with it anyway. Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, Mark Meadows, provided powerful evidence that could be used to charge Donald Trump with seditious conspiracy. In her public testimony at a January 6 committee hearing, Cassidy Hutchinson said that Mr. Trump was informed that many in the throng of supporters waiting to hear him speak on the Ellipse on that day were armed, but that he demanded that they be allowed to skip the metal detectors that had been installed for his security. "They're not here to hurt me," he said, according to Ms. Hutchinson. "Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here." If Merrick Garland decides to pursue prosecution, a message that the Justice Department must send early and often is that even if Mr. Trump genuinely believed, as he claimed, that the election had been marred by fraud, his schemes to interfere in the certification of the vote would still be crimes. And even though Mr. Trump's efforts failed, these efforts would still be crimes. More than 850 other Americans have already been charged with crimes for their roles in the Capitol attack. Well-meaning intentions did not shield them from the consequences of their actions. It would be unjust if Donald Trump, the man who inspired them, faced no consequences. No one should revel in the prospect of this or any former president facing criminal prosecution. Donald Trump's actions have brought shame on America and destabilized its future. Even justice before the law will not erase that stain. Nor will prosecuting Mr. Trump fix the structural problems that led to the greatest crisis in American democracy since the Civil War. But it is a necessary first step toward doing so.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently visited Africa and said Moscow is currently developing a new foreign policy to counter fresh Western sanctions. Speaking in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on the last leg of his landmark visit to Africa last July, Lavrov noted that many countries are ending reliance on the United States dollar.
The reliance on dollar as the instrument supporting the world economy is not very promising, frankly speaking. And it is not by incident that more and more countries are shifting to using alternative currencies, shifting to use national currencies more and more. This process will be gaining momentum.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the recent visit to Africa by Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in what was seen as a diplomatic charm offensive amid tensions with Western countries over Moscow's military operations in Ukraine. The second part of our show will be on a report of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, which urged African countries to rethink export diversification. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Russia counters West in Africa. Late July, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited four African countries in a bid to strengthen ties with the continent amid a six-month-old conflict in Ukraine. Lavrov visited Egypt, the Republic of the Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia, where he met with high-level officials and held discussions on bilateral, regional, and international relations. Speaking to Sputnik News, Lavrov described African countries as trying to define their own futures and solve their own problems as part of a trend towards a multipolar world. He accused the West of opposing such multipolar world in its pursuit of U.S. hegemony.
Africa's ties with Russia are based on Russia's historical support for the anti-colonial movement in Africa. Speaking during the 2019 Russia-Africa summit in Sochi, Russian President Vladimir Putin elaborated on the historical ties between the two sides.
Gathered here today are representatives of all 54 African countries and leading regional organizations. Dear friends, Russia and Africa are tied with traditionally friendly relationship. Our country has been consistently supporting the national liberation movement of the peoples of Africa. It has contributed significantly into the emerging of young states, developing their economy, establishing combat-capable armed forces. Our cooperation, which goes back to the period of joint fight against colonialism, is of strategic and long-term nature.
Now, to discuss the recent visit to Africa by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, we contacted Greg Simons, author and researcher, and would like to thank him for accepting our invitation today. Now, our first question, Africa and Russia enjoyed very cordial ties, especially during the Soviet Union, but these relations waned after the collapse of the Union. Now, what is the motivation behind Russia's renewed strategic interest in Africa?
Well, I mean, if you look at what Russia has been saying and doing in terms of its foreign policy priorities over the last at least 10, 15 years, it's been reorienting itself away from this Western-centric world towards a non-Western-centric world. And Africa has been part of that. And, I mean, in terms of relationships, certainly. I mean, if we look at the Soviet Union and its support for the independence movements and, in some cases, some of the reconstruction and aid which was given during the formative years of African countries' independence, it's got a good basis for coming back.
During his visit to Uganda, Sergei Lavrov got a warm reception from President Yoweri Museveni, who had been a key ally of the West for decades. During the meeting with Lavrov, Museveni defended his country's relationship with Russia. The Ugandan president was emphatic that his country cannot be against Russia. Let's take a listen.
And that is our relationship with Russia. Russia, so the Soviet Union, supporting the anti-colonial movement in Africa. We say, but you people, these people have been with us for the last 100 years. How can we be automatically against them? We have even forgiven our former enemies, the colonialists, the ones who had colonized us, the ones who had actually taken slaves from here and did bad things. We have forgiven them and we are working with them. How can we be against somebody who has never harmed us and who instead helped us?
Now, I would like to ask Mr. Simon his opinion about this statement by President Museveni.
Well, of course, I mean, he's saying it rather, well, directly, that the West has never really been there to help Uganda. I mean, they talk about these things, but of course, the British colonized it, and Americans have been exploiting not only Uganda, but the African continent, depending on where resources are most abundant. So what he's saying is that there is a basis of a symmetrical and a reciprocal relationship between Russia and African countries, which has not been poisoned, if we want to call it that, by historical experience of colonization by other